1975. We're here with Frank Felt, F-E-L-T, and Betty Chamay, C-H-M-A-J, and Dennis East to interview Mr. Felt. Mr. Felt, would you please start off with a biographical sketch of yourself, your early life, and whatever you feel you want to cover at this point?
Start with when and where you were born.
Well, I was born in Hamtramck Township at that time, November 28, 1913. Raised and educated. Finished high school, Southeastern High School, 1931. And
education, then, high school degree?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then 1938, I start serving apprenticeship in the tool and die trade, which I finished in the 40s. And that's the extent of my formal education as such.
Might I suggest that we back up here to get background for your involvement in the labor movement on the one hand and the ideals that you live by on the other hand, by going back a couple of generations to Finland. Mm-hmm. And your grandparents. Can you remember anything
yes,
about
them? Yes, well, the only thing I can remember of grandparents would actually be on my father's side. And his grandfather, two brothers, they migrated from Sweden into Finland, and then my father and his father were born in Finland, in Heckfors, which is a industrial town.
Would you spell the name?
Helsing. At that time, well, it's called Karkila now, but it was Heckfors, H-O-G-F-O-R-S.
And this is the industrial area outside
of
Helsinki.
That was just out of Helsinki, which now is a suburb of Helsinki. But it was an industrial foundry which made pots and pans. You know, they call it in Finnish the patapuruki.
Was your grandfather involved in working in urban area industrial work? Or was he from
really,
the
I
farm?
I couldn't very remember. Well say because his mother died when he was young, and
he was an infant,
and he had two brothers and one sister. And the two brothers were in the Russian army.
Okay, that's now let's get the story. Your father had two brothers and one sister, and the two brothers were in the Russian army.
Right.
So that your father was the maverick. He was the one who was different.
Well, he was the youngest in the family. I guess he wasn't old enough to be put into the army at that time.
Okay, now, where does your father's involvement with the labor movement begin?
Well, he served his apprenticeship in this foundry in Heckfors and become a journeyman. And at that time, he joined and become a member of the International Motors Union. The International Motors Union.
So International Motors Union?
International Motors.
And idea of a date for that?
Well, that probably would have been, let's see, he migrated to this country in 1903. I would say that he was born in 1871.
Oh boy, I don't know my father's birth date. That's great.
1871, born. July 13th.
But what you're saying is that there was a strong labor movement in Finland.
Well,
before the turn of the century, anyone in
that particular area that worked in that or was a tradesman belonged to a union.
Okay. Okay. Now he has to migrate in 1903. You say.
Well, he migrated in 1903 simply because it was approaching 1905, and Finland being under Russia, they were suppressing the labor movement as such because of the political repercussions.
And your father felt that in very direct ways?
He felt that in a direct way.
Was he an activist?
Well, he was an activist in his union.
in his union, that's what I meant, so that he had been singled out for someone to, so he felt he'd better get out of there.
Right. In fact, I think he was a recording secretary, if I recall correctly, which he'd become in the Finnish movement when he...
Okay, now, that's, your father's story is first of all the story, right?
Yeah,
that's what you said. Now, your father comes to America in 1903.
1903.
And he comes straight to Detroit?
No, no. No, he landed in Nova Scotia. Landed in Nova Scotia, come down through Canada, but he was, his visa was directly to the United States. In other words, he just come a roundabout way. He come across on a cattle boat, a wooden cattle boat that was making its last trip.
Is that right?
It squeaked and groaned. It took him 31 days to get across the ocean.
Was there some reason? Was it cheaper to
come
that way?
Well, it was cheaper. I mean, he didn't have the money. And,
It wasn't that he was hiding or...
No, it was a cheap mode of transportation.
Yeah, well, that's the
immigrant
story.
And it landed up there in
Nova Scotia. It's cold up there.
Up there, yeah.
Okay, then how does he get to Detroit?
Well, roundabout way through Canada, Toronto and Windsor, and then over to Detroit because all his friends from that particular area were settling in Detroit.
Okay, friends from that particular area of Finland.
Yeah. Right.
And were they joining? Were they getting involved in the auto industry? Well, we don't really have an auto industry yet.
Well, we didn't really have an auto industry at that time, but eventually they all become involved in the automobile industry.
And he becomes active, you said, in the labor movement here.
Well, he was a member of the International Molders Union, and he got union wages as soon as he got a job here in the city of Detroit because he was a union member, you know. And in fact, that was $3 a day at that time. You know, he was always proud to mention the fact that he was able to get $3 a day, you know.
And he felt that the union got credit for that.
Well, naturally, yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, he wouldn't have received that amount of money.
Did he, do you know, feel any difference between the pressure on the labor movement here or the labor movement in Finland? Was it?
Well, he had more freedom here.
More freedom here.
I would say that.
Well, I suppose with if he had felt that he had to leave, couldn't be much
freedom
worse.
Freedom of movement, yeah.
And was that more due to this union, more typical of this
union
than others?
No, it was still the same. He still belonged to the same union. It was the International Molders Union. You know, it was an international.
Okay.
So it didn't,
I'm not sure where the union movement generally is at this time. I'm wondering whether the Finns were tended to be union people generally. Or the Finns that he knew would be?
Well, the ones that he knew
obviously were would be,
people that worked with him. Most of these people like, Nicander and Mack and Mackey and quite an Eklund, which is out there.
Mack and Eklund from at the Finn camp?
Well, this Eklund is...
many Eklunds.
Yeah, this Eklund is this Mrs. Eklund. Yeah. Husband had died a couple of years ago.
But anyway, a lot of them were involved in union.
Well, they were all
tradesmen.
They were all tradesmen. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of questions.
Yeah.
Was Felt your father's name when he came here?
Yeah, F-A-L-D-T. But when they asked him his name in landing, he said Felt. And so the immigration guy, he figured, well, F-E-L-D-T, and spelled it. In a German
F-E-L-D-T.
But actually it's F-A, you know, with the two dots on the top, L-D-T.
Okay, your mother's name?
Fina Vuori.
Can you spell that?
F-I-N-A, that's her first name, and Vuori was V-O-U-R-I-I.
And your father's first name?
Franz Friedel.
And your brothers and sisters' names?
Oni, Toivo and Alma.
Oni was the one who
O-N-N.
Who went to Spanish
Spain, yeah.
Spain
yeah.
the Spanish
O-N-N.
Civil War.
O N N I actually that's spelled Finnish.
And
Alma E-L-M-A and Toivo is T-O-I-V-O. Oni means luck and Toivo means hope.
I didn't know
literally.
That Toivo means hope.
Yeah. So then I was the youngest, so my father finally named me after him. He figured, well, that's it.
Oh, so he named his youngest after himself. Yeah. My father did the same thing.
Okay. Okay, when he came over in 1903.
Yeah, right.
Did your mother come with him?
No, they met here in Detroit.
They met in Detroit.
They met in 1906. They got married in 7.
Do you know where she was working or where they met?
Well, she come here to work in, she was a domestic.
Domestic.
Okay. And they met, she lived downtown and he lived downtown. At that time, all the people lived right in within the radius of, I'd say, 2 miles of City Hall, you know.
So what, on the near east side of, or right. Where?
Yeah, on the near east side. Mm-hmm. That's where they lived, yeah.
You say you were born in Hamtramck Township
right.
In 1913.
Yeah, that's Harper and Van Dyke now. That's Detroit, see.
Harper and
Van
Dyke.
Time, at that time, Hamtramck, oh heck, it ran all the way from everything east of Van Dyke and north of Harper was Hamtramck.
Okay.
At the time I was born.
Your family had moved out there.
Yeah.
We're living there at the time.
They moved there.
Was this also an area of Finnish concentration?
Right.
Why was the move made from downtown to Harper and Van Dyke?
Well, they wanted to own a home. See, they were all renting when they were downtown, and people start buying homes, and so they wanted to own a home, so they bought a home in this relatively new subdivision, so to speak, at that time.
Where did your father work? What company, or do you know?
He worked in small job shops. He was a jobbing molder, what you'd call a jobbing molder. He was no production molder, you know.
And you entered into a tool and die apprenticeship
in 1938.
What were the circumstances around your getting involved in the apprenticeship, or what was the any problems in becoming an apprentice?
No, not really. I just decided that if I had to work for a living, well, I'm going to work at something where it's worthwhile spending my time, you know. And I figured tool and die would be the...
Did you work with your father?
No.
Where did you take your apprenticeship?
No, I just in the small job shops.
No,
I wasn't a formal... They didn't establish formal apprenticeship programs in the city of Detroit until 1941, the UAW.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they set up a formal apprenticeship program. 41 or 42, no, I'm not quite sure of the accurate date. But
and when did you finish your apprenticeship?
In 1941.
And then where were you working? Still in the small shops?
Yeah, right. I worked job shops until...
What do you mean, job shops?
Well, that's them small shops. They're shops that bid on work, dies, tools and dies that be built for the big automotive companies. And that's the nature of their being and existence.
Non-unionized at the time?
Well, at that time, the shop I was in belonged to what they call a craftsman's union. It was a kind of a company union deal. It was active tool and die.
Would you say but, as the...
But I served my time in non-union shops at that time.
Would you say that there's a large percentage, I don't know exactly how many that would be, but a large percentage of Finns were into the skilled work at this time, or were they beginning to move into the unskilled in their 30s and before the 30s into the mass production automobile industry?
They were basically at least the ones that I was acquainted with were basically either skilled or semi-skilled tradesmen. By semi-skilled, I mean like these sheet metal finishers and sheet metal power hammermen. And the Finns, there was quite a number of them, you know. And like Carl's father, well.
Carl's John, he was Carl, talking about the Carl, pride they took
yeah,
in that,
he was,
working hard.
Yeah, he was brought into it by his father, you know, into the trade, into the sheet metal trade.
Would you say most of your work in the job shops was with Finns, or?
No.
Pretty much a mixture of
right.
The different?
Very few Finns that I worked with, really, in reality, in the shops. Although I did work with his Benthien at Coleman's. he was a boss there in layout, and I worked in Tryon. He wasn't my boss, but.
Oh. But he was there.
When did you become a union member, and how did you get involved in
Well, I became a union member as soon as we started organizing. And that was back in 19... Well, as soon as I got involved politically during the Depression. I got involved into first the unemployed councils, and then from there progressed into little political cadres, I got more or less a free, I would call it a free education.
Can you recall why you became involved in the unemployed councils, or
well,
why you became in the different political groups?
Well, basically, on account of the background of the family, my father, he was always a good, strong union man, and he spoke favorably about current events of the day. I mean, he was able to analyze. We had discussions at home, and my brother, I would say, mainly because my brother Oney was got involved first, you know, and then he got us involved, my other brother and myself, and.
So it was a family affair.
Yeah, it developed into a family affair, yeah.
It's interesting, in contrast to your to your uncles who were on the Russian side, in contrast to your father.
So before you became an apprentice in 1938, where were you working, or what were you doing,
I worked in production.
Where?
Well, I sat down at Dodge's in 1937 for the 89 days of the sit-down strike.
That was when you met your wife.
No, I met my wife in 1939.
Okay, I have two years off. 1937.
1939, I met my wife.
Yeah, but 1937, you were involved with the sit down strike.
Right.
Sat down at Dodge.
Yeah, for the whole period of 89 days, we sat down at Dodge's. But prior to that, well, let's say when I got out of high school, there was no jobs. It was in the midst of the Depression, 1931. So my buddy and I, we kind of bum around the country, and hoboed, so to speak, rode freights and hitchhiked and shock wheat out west. And knocked on doors to get something to eat and offered to do work in order to for the food, and generally just traveling around because there was nothing else to do, really. And at the same time, we seen the country. And then come back into Detroit.
Do you remember when?
Well, let's see, 1933. So 2 years, kind of bum around the country. 1933, come back, and then got involved into the, in fact, was already involved in the unemployment council deal, but got more involved as we got back. And then we got involved into getting relief for single men.
You're telling that story, tell that.
Weren't getting any relief at all, and so we start fighting for relief for single men. We heard that on East Jefferson they had this office that if we put up a battle, we could get all single men, you know, the ones that were living at home or the ones that were homeless, you know, to get them relief.
Now, office of what?
Well, it would be
government?
No, it would be welfare. It would be the city, Detroit City.
Okay, city yeah, welfare.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was on East Jefferson. Let's see if I remember the the address was 118 or something like that, close by. And anyways, then again, it was my brother that kind of led that deal, and it ended up with them. Trying to think of this supervisor's name. He was a man. I can't recall his name offhand, but he refused to meet with the committee. We were a committee going down there to, we were going to put up our demands for relief, and he refused to meet with us. So there was a church across the street, and on these steps, we were sitting on these steps, and I walked away. I think I had to go to the toilet or something, and I walked away. And in the meanwhile, one of the boys had a little mirror, and he was shining it and reflecting it into the window of this supervisor. And I guess he called the police, and then he had them arrested. And so then the following day, we went down there to the court, and, or was it the following day? I guess it was the following day. And my brother and those that were arrested, well, my brother was a spokesman, and they spoke for themselves, and they says that the only reason that they were down there was because they were fighting for to get some relief, because they haven't got any money, and they were hungry, and they wanted a place to stay, and so on and so forth. So the judge dismissed charges on him, and this, I can't think of his name. Anyways, he told him to come down to the office. He told us all to come down there, and he wrote up and gave us relief tickets, and those that didn't have a place to stay, they had what they called a Ballington Club on East Jefferson, and the YMCAs, they rented space in the YMCAs where they put the homeless to stay. So my brother, he went and stayed at the YMCA, and there was a couple others there that went to the Ballington Club because they had no other place to stay. So then we passed the word around through the grapevine, so to speak, that now you can go down there and get relief, you know, all single men. So a big horde of them hit the doors, you know. And,
so they're all going down to East Jefferson.
Yeah, right.
So. Was this done through a particular organization?
No, we more or less done this on our own, you know. Well, of course, we were, you could call us political in a sense that...
Okay, this is what I'm getting at. You had to have a place where you met and where you talked about these things. Where was that?
Right. Oh, yeah, that was on Centerline Avenue at that time. Now it's called St. Cyril. That's right on in the Harper Van Dyke region. I would say that, well, it's right behind the Burroughs Intermediate School. Right there.
But what kind of group was it? Was it a labor group?
It was this unemployed council, and then there was a little political group, the Young Communist League,
okay.
YCL.
The YCL was meeting at this, and you were not just one ethnic group, you were from many groups.
Right. Poles, Finns. Well, we were the Finns, and there was other Finns besides ourselves in it, and Poles. And
do you remember any other nationalities? Serbs.
Yeah. And Lithuanians.
Oh yeah.
These Lithuanian gals.
Were you? Was your? I kind of sense that your brother, Oni.
Oni, yeah.
Was more of an influence on you in these matters, perhaps, than your father.
Right.
Particularly during the Depression days of the 30s.
Right.
Was he the one that introduced you to the unemployed councils and the YCL?
Right.
And this is a nebulous term, but would you say he was in the leadership of the unemployed councils in Detroit at the time?
Well, in that particular region, yes. You know, I mean, district.
Yeah, what were the functions you met? Do you remember the name of the place where you met? Was it a workers' hall, or was it restaurant, or what was it?
We rented this building, and it wasn't called anything. It was just an old building. It's still there. And we didn't give it any particular name.
But there was just, had the whole building.
We rented the building. Yeah. Well, it was one big, it's an old store building, and there's one big room, you know. Mm-hmm. It used to be the store.
So that's where you'd hang
out?
We called it
the Unemployment Council Hall, that's all, you know. because basically that's who set it up in the first place. And in fact, at that time, the fellow that got my brother into it, he was the head of the unemployed council, and that's Art Siren. You know, the guy that pitched his horseshoes
Jesus,
out there
with the white hair.
Sireni, yeah.
I wish you get him interviewed.
Yeah.
Art Siren got your brother involved.
Yeah, well, he was the head of the unemployed council at that time. He's the one that got Oni involved in the unemployed council.
I'll be darned. I see him out there every Sunday pitching horseshoes? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, old Silver Fox.
Yeah. back to Dennis's question. Were you motivated? You were motivated by hunger, obviously, but idealism too?
Well, yeah, idealism and, starvation, but...
Did you read or did you share
people, read.
Certain philosophies,
oh, yes.
Like
we read.
Now?
We read very widely read books, pro and con, and we had our arguments in our meetings, so to speak. You know, everyone expressed their own viewpoints, and... But the economic situation at that time was such that, what else was there to do? And this was a wholesome, healthy activity as far as we were concerned. You know?
Yeah, that's going to connect later on with what I want to ask about the FinCamp, because again and again I hear that the same idealism, the same kind of interest in wholesome, healthy physical and educational activity led to the program at the FinCamp,
yeah,
especially for children.
That's true. But there, in itself, I would say the motivating factors were unemployment and no jobs, very little luxuries, so to speak. Whenever we enjoyed any luxuries, it would be probably be in the wintertime, we'd go out and shovel snow out in Grosse Pointe, you know.
That's a luxury.
Yeah, and then we'd earn a little money. We'd take the streetcar with our snow shovels and go out there and shovel snow. And here, we're teenagers, you know, at that time, we're teenagers. And that was a... If you look at the picture, it's a heck of a lot different now of a teenager going out and taking a snow shovel and going out shoveling snow. First, they want to know how much they're going to get paid before they even pick up a shovel.
Well, that's for sure. I can speak for my teenager.
But, and then we'd, at that time we had this one young fella, he was a Canadian, Earl Park, and his mother and father got divorced, and his mother was a domestic and she was working, so Earl, he had no place to stay, and because she lived in where she was working, and his father had taken off, so we had an old Model T Ford in our backyard, and he starts sleeping in there, you know, an old Ford coupe, and heck, we finally told our mother, we said, well, we can't let him stay out there, he might as well come and stay in the house, so he lived with us for 2 years, and you know, he lived up in the attic. We made up a nice bed right next to the chimney, and it was in good shape. And he became involved with us in this political activity.
Okay, when did you're active in the unemployed councils?
Yeah.
You're agitating for relief for single men.
We'd go out to the welfare offices
right.
and with committees and fight.
When did you go to work? At this time, or were you working?
No.
Other than shoveling snow.
Shoveling snow and wherever you could make a buck, you know. No,
okay,
I
you
had
said,
no had no regular job at that time, no.
Okay. When did you go to work?
1934, regularly.
And where was that?
Over to Dodge's.
At Dodge?
Yeah.
Doing what?
I hired in there, the Finns were all, at that time, sheet metal power hammermen, and they were... And my neighbor, Mr. Helgren, he lived right over there, Lachman, and they lived. They were sheet metal hammermen working at Dodge's, and he says, "Heck, they want a power hammerman's helper down here, you know. So why don't you come down and ask for the job?" So I went down there and. And evidently they had talked to the boss and he had put in a requisition, you know, for a helper. And I got hired as Frank Felt, you know, my right name. Mm-hmm. And I went to work, but I wasn't of legal age. They found out later, you know, after I had been working on a power hammer for about 3 months. About 3 months, and the foreman came around. He says, "Frank, you're not of legal age to be running a machine, you know." So you, so they put me onto metal finishing. You know.
How? What was the legal age?
At that time, let's see, 21.
I see. Legal to for that particular
for,
job.
Yeah, for that. Yeah.
Okay.
To run a machine, you know. And so. Whether that was the reason or not, I don't know, but I assume that was the reason. But at the same time, at that time, we were still, our group, you know, still held together, and we were agitating for unionism, the old auto workers union, which was not the UAW, but the so-called Red Union. They called it the Red Union. That led the 1932 strike at Briggs, led by Phil Raymond.
You know it, I don't.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was a forerunner, actually it was a forerunner into industrial unionism, because these people that got involved with them were more or less political minded people, and they could see that this had to come about eventually, and they were fighting for it, but unfortunately they were labeled as a Red Union, and that destroyed lots of the effectiveness of the auto workers union as such. But we had stickers.
Do you remember when the label came?
Pardon?
Do you remember when the label came and who started it?
Well, it come during the 1932 strike, you know, with Phil Raymond led, you know. And Phil Raymond was a known communist, but he was the leader of the Briggs strike at Briggs. And talking about that strike, my brother got involved there too. He went down there this one day for mass picketing, and the Detroit mounted police come over to break up the whole picket line, you know, the whole thing. And they were swinging their clubs and so forth. So my brother took one of, at that time they had cobblestones yet, you know. Took a big cobblestone and knocked this one cop off his horse. Right? So the others seen that and they start chasing him, and he run down the alley and jumped over a few fences, and then he finally jumped in this one yard, and this lady evidently was sympathetic. She says, "Come on, get in the house, you know, call him into the house." And they were all around. They knew he was around in that vicinity somewhere, but they couldn't find him.
Sounds like something out of a movie.
You know? But that was a little incident during that 32 strike. He also, my father and him and old man Yulku, Mr. Yulku, they participated in the Ford Hunger March, you know, and which took place, I believe it was in 32 too.
32. You were traveling out of the city at that time.
Yeah, but they took part in this Ford Hunger March, and they met at the Woodmere Cemetery on the west side. That's where the whole people from throughout the whole city gathered, and they met there, and then from there there was a march over to Ford's, and that's when the Ford shot down these what were they, four, yeah. Bulgarians, a couple of them were Bulgarians, and I think a couple were Serbian. They were mostly from the east side, from around Ferry Hall. And Ferry Hall was a Serbian hall, actually, you know. The Serbian ethnic group owned that hall. They built the hall and they used it. But they also rented this hall out to other organizations that wanted to rent it. And we used to go to dances and stuff there, and they'd have parties there.
Ferry Hall was also known as Workers' Hall.
It was known as the Workers' Hall.
That's the point.
It had another label, yeah.
that's the hall where the Ford Hunger March originated.
No, it didn't actually originate there. That at Ferry Hall, those people from the east side that were going to the Ford Hunger March met there and marched over to Woodmere Cemetery, where people from all sides of the city met at Woodmere, and then from there, the initial march began. You know.
So that was just one.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
But just like when the Ford Hunger March started.
Yeah.
A large body of people started it
from Ferry
Worker
Hall.
Hall or Ferry
from Ferry Hall.
They came down Ferry to Woodward and then down Woodward to Michigan Avenue.
Right. They marched all the way to the Woodmere Cemetery.
Right.
Yeah.
When you went to work at Dodge's in 1934, were you engaged in union political activities while you were working there? Or were you attempting to organize into what? Into
the Auto Workers Union.
The Auto Workers Union.
Yeah.
And do you recall the attitude of workers that you were with? And also, what were some of your activities there? Were you leafleting? What?
Yeah. Well, as far as the activity was concerned, we had stickers that we'd stick up by the drinking fountains, stick them up into the locker room. At that time, they hung their coats up on racks way up in the air on a big, long wooden deal, you know, and then we'd put these stickers right on that hanger that they had, that long wooden hanger that they had hanging. And discussions with time. You didn't have very much time to discuss things, but when you did get a little time, like at lunch hour or something, with the younger fellows who talked the thing over and said, geez, we have to work like hell, you know. I mean, it'd be good if we had a union in the place, you know. Just carried on a general conversation in that respect. And we also met, we were also still political, you know. And we had this little group, and within this group was a guy named Earl Gurney, who later on, after the sit-downs, during the sit-down strikes, or right after the sit-down, the La Follette Investigations Committee that was investigating these labor spies and so on and so forth, turned him up as a labor spy working for the Railway Audit Company of Connecticut. I think Railway Audit, I think it's Connecticut or Massachusetts, one of those East Coast places. And he was actually working for them at all the while he was in the political movement, as well as anything else. In other words, he was a stool pigeon.
Stool pigeon. In your group.
In our group. And he was also on the district committee of the YCL at that time.
Oh. You know?
And we always wondered why, you know, we all smoked cigarettes at that time, and we always wondered why he always had fresh cigarettes, you know. We always wondered how Earl Gurney always got these fresh cigarettes, you know. And evidently, you know, his pay, he served as master as well, I guess.
Oh, dear. How did you find out?
Well, I say, during the La Follette Investigations Committee revealed him as one of the stooges for Railway Audit Company. The Railway Audit, that's who he worked for. And
in your working there and organizing workers and talking them politically and so on, were you primarily responsible for talking to Finns, or were you talking to anybody?
No, anyone. Because the Finns that were working in there knew me, you know, and they knew our background, and they were sympathetic as far as union were concerned, but they weren't activists, you know.
Politically.
They were older. Pardon?
They weren't politically
active. Well, they weren't union activists either, you know, in that sense of the word. They were just sympathetic, and then they become activists after we established the union, you know, after the UAW, the CIO established the United Auto Workers Union, and then they joined and become activists. They were more or less passive, I would say, you know.
Yes, I think
they weren't all that.
Was
just like Sullo himself, you know, he was no activist in a trade union until
after the
union was established. Then he was not an activist, he was a member.
Well, he said he was involved in underground activities, but the point that you make is one that we should stress, and Angela stressed it as well, And that is that your involvement was with other ethnic groups, and it
right.
Is in some sense different from, but it also, what's the word, contradicts the notion that Finns worked together with Finns only, that there were some who were,
right,
and the Finn camp history is involved here because
that's
you
correct.
Brought some of your friends from other nationalities out to the Finn camp,
that's
and
the
Finns didn't care for that.
No, they thought their
much.
Daughters were going to get bastardized by Poles or whatever.
A familiar
come out
kind
with
of
us, or Jews, or you know,
yeah.
And we had Jewish friends, we had Polish friends, and we invited them out to our camp. You know, we had a camp out there.
And,
so we
and your camp was known as, I mean, you were known
for
democratizing,
right.
Mixing
well,
with lots
would,
of other people.
I would, yeah, I would say that it was a.
This was yeah.
That was a kind of a deal with them.
At Dodge's at this time, would you say there was a strong ethnic identity? Finns with Finns, Poles with Poles, Croatians with Croatians, Irish with Irish.
Yes, I would say that. I would say that.
Do you think that the company utilized the ethnic diversity and the ethnic characters?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And if so, could you tell us how or give us an example?
Well, I imagine they use Finns. Finns are hard workers, you know, and they use them to show another group of, say, Poles or something that were doing similar work, you know, that look, I mean, these guys can knock out so much work in an hour, you know, can't you guys do any better, you know, or are these Finlanders, you know, so much greater than your nationality, you know, I mean, they use it in that sense. And I would say they use all national groups in the same manner, you know, to suit their own needs and suit their own
to get production and
yeah, and their own ambitions, you know, to become superintendents and so on and so
in
forth.
In your own case, do you ever remember a time? I mean, I certainly do, and I'm several generations
yeah.
removed from the original Finnish group, but. Feeling well, you know, I'm a Finn, so
yeah.
I can do this harder work, or
yeah.
feeling pride in that in
yeah.
Sisu.
Yeah, Sisu. Yeah.
Do you remember that feeling that, and then thinking later, well, my Lord, they're getting more work out of me by.
Well, not really. I wouldn't say in that sense. I always felt that. I'll put it this way that. All the Finnish people that we were acquainted with, our families, you know, were acquainted with, were all steady, hard-working people, you know.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether they were production workers or skilled workers, they worked steadily. And they also, on the other hand, they are also pretty good drinking people, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And partying. They used to have their affairs and drink. My father was a heavy drinker, and so were his friends. And
I guess,
I imagine the nature of some of their work too, like these sheet metal workers, hammermen and metal finishers. They made good money at that. In fact, they made more, and they were semi-skilled. They made more money than skilled tradesmen, simply because they worked on piecework and they, the more they produced, the more they made, and they made big money. They were the so-called aristocrats amongst the Finnish people. Yeah. They were considered as such.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At Dodge's, wasn't there a union pretty much led by Richard Frankenstein?
Yeah, I don't recall the real initials, but they had the AIWIA, and they had the. There was about five different. Unions, because after we got the right to organize, and they were established, and Frankenstein was the head of this. I believe it was the AIWIA or something like
that. AIWA, I think.
And
that was one of the groups, along with MESA, the Mechanics Educational Society, which
yeah,
came together and merged
yeah,
with the UAW
right,
when UAW
right,
was,
right,
was
right.
formed.
And then they split also, though. The Mechanics Educational Society of America, as such, did not affiliate with the UAW, but they split, their ranks split, and the MESA what remained. And then there was another group, went under Griffin, a guy named Griffin established the Craftsmen's Union, called the Craftsmen's Union. That was another split of the skilled tradesmen that were at that time in the MESA. And that was all an offshoot from the MESA.
But
the majority of them went into the UAW-CIO.
Which you did also.
Right.
Most of the Mesa and Craftsman Union pretty much stayed AF of L oriented, American Federation of Labor.
Mesa did. The Craftsman Union turned out to be just a little company union deal, you know, mm-hmm. where they had to belong. At that time, even without any fight, they got the right to have the people belong to their union before they even started to work there. You know,
but you were never a member of the Frankenstein's,
no,
what's AI, called Frankenstein's
AIWA, no, no.
So when the union came, you went right into UAW.
1936, Nat Ganley got a hold of me and he says, Frank, he says, 50 cents, you better join the UAW right now, you know. And that was a Loon Lake.
You're no kidding.
Yeah. And so I forked over 50 cents, and that's when I became.